First, I'd like to say thanks to Aida for inviting me to speak, and also for her endless patience in explaining to me the subtleties and complexities of UDC over the last year, as I've been looking at using it again for interactive TV. So I'm very humbled to have the chance to speak here today and to offer suggestions for some tricks and techniques that might lead to greater exploitation of subject classification in modern information systems. And I should say I'm going to speak partly from notes so that I can be clear what I say, and partly from the chaos in my head. We'll move to the chaos part as we talk about television. So I think there's something we can do here that will give us more useful, more usable, more flexible information systems. And it's not hard, but I feel a bit awkward asking you to do it. So we'll come to that later. So I'm going to use my time up here to ask you to rethink some of the basic collaborative practices of the subject classification profession. And don't worry, it's easier than it sounds. First, I got to begin with a little confession. And it's one of these English confessions that's not really a confession. I'm not a librarian. I'm not a subject expert. I don't know what I am. So all you need to know about me, I'm an accidental technologist. 15 years ago, I was a philosophy graduate who got involved pretty early on in the rise of the web. Basically, I was starting a PhD, and I got distracted by the web. The web was far more interesting and dynamic than doing a PhD. So early in the life of the web, I got very involved with describing things. I put the first philosophy guide on the web. I did it myself. I built it around some existing internet guides that were out there. And it got me into this community, trying to figure out how we deal with this massive, massive information resource. So early on, I met Deborah Higham and Nikki Ferguson, who created the Sausage Project in 94. At the same time, Yahoo was just starting up. And we were all wondering, how does this relate to existing practice? How do you describe these resources professionally in a way that makes them easy to find? So I've been involved ever since, really, in this crossover between the library world and the world of the internet and the web. So I've spent a lot of my career working on those borderlines between web standards and digital libraries. In the mid to late 90s, through the Sausage collaboration, through the Desire project, the ELIB program in the UK, I was part of this community working on hybrid techniques, mixing library practice for cataloging web pages and web crawlers. We took, for example, the Sausage database, which was, I think at the time, 1,000 or so professionally described internet resources. They had UDC codes, they had keywords, they had nice descriptions. And we combined that with some of the tools from the Desire project. We combined it with a search engine. So we crawled maybe 50,000 or a million pages and tried to build an integrated system that had the best of search engines and the best of human resources. It sort of worked and sort of didn't. So I'm here 10 years later. 10 years and 1 month ago, I was in another room in this building in a workshop we had in the Desire project for European National Libraries, talking about the subject gateway movement, this idea that we would have a distributed network of catalogers improving access to the web through describing it with professional descriptions. That work gave rise to something you heard about yesterday, and we'll hear a little bit more about later today, which is the SCOS work. SCOS was a project to exchange thesaurus-like and, to some extent, classification system-like data in the web. I'll come to that later. What I hope to do today is really give you a webby perspective. I'm a web person. I'm a technologist. I've spent a lot of time very close to the library world, but my heart's in the web, I have to say. Give a webby perspective on subject classification and its place in the evolving world of the web. So I want to give some guiding principles that we can use to improve the pace of collaboration, of progress and innovation in the field. And I hope they might seem rather obvious, even painfully obvious afterwards. Sometimes it is important to state the obvious. I hope they might also seem just a little bit idealistic. So this is the somewhat inevitable history slide. This is stuff that you guys have seen before. This is subject classification going back over 100 years. You know this history. Modern web developers do not know this history. They don't feel a sense of connection to this work. As I've read about Paul Otley, I've realized that he built the first Google, more or less. As I've dug into the history of subject classification just a bit, I realized that the work that web developers do today, the work that the software engineers who create tools like Firefox, which is a web browser, like Drupal, which is a website content management system, like OpenOffice, which creates documents on the desktop, they're part of a more or less unbroken tradition going back way before the web, and they don't realize it. So this is a nice newspaper cutting I found from a Library of Congress archive that shows estimates of the size of the information mess from over 100 years ago. It was 12,163,000 works and somewhat more periodicals. So back then it was big, and it's been getting bigger ever since. The Google blog last year said that they had now encountered 1 trillion, so in their measure, million distinct URLs on the web. That's, we all know there's a lot out there. And I think what we don't know is what to do about it. There's sometimes a sinking feeling in the digital library community as we look at all the work that was done over the last 100 years, all the projects around subject gateways that, to be honest, have a hard time being a full part of the web. And the sense of what do we do? It's just got so big, there's so much information, the professional practice, the professional data sets are being ignored in the modern web. What do we do about that? How do we bridge these worlds? I think that there's no single answer. As I listened to the talks yesterday, it was very clear to me that there are 1,000 small answers, 1,000 techniques and approaches that have been explored in this community to modernize subject classification, to bring it into the web, to bring it into the style of practice that makes sense on a mobile phone, that makes sense when people are navigating information, not by going to a library, but by speaking into their mobile phone. I can pull my iPhone out of my pocket now, speak to it, and it will find me a web page. This is just amazing. And the people who make this software, the people who've made the, 100,000, 10,000 applications on the iPhone, they don't know about UDC. They don't know about SCoS yet. They don't know about all the work that preceded the web. And I think that's a really tragic situation. So with one foot in each world, I'm trying to think, what can we do to improve that? Many of the techniques we heard about yesterday are complementary. We heard several projects that have been trying to build more usable information resources on a base of UDC, but then with local customizations. They talked about bridging to Thesaurite, using UDC to help improve Thesaurite. There was a lot of very international work with translations and mappings. At the moment, all this work is happening in closed data sets in isolated separate software systems. When we're lucky, it's happening at a national level or between collaborations of museums. And somehow we need to break out of that box. Most classification work today, professional classification work, is hidden from most of humanity. And to me, that's really a crying shame. So I'm going to go back to basics today, back to the origins of the web, and back to the origins of subject classification, which I think was also incredibly idealistic. If you look at the work around the Mondaneum, around Dewey Decimal and UDC and their birth, it to some people today it seems naive, but it was also beautiful. They were trying to connect up all information, make it universally available. And we have so much of that today with the web, but we're also missing so much of the original vision. And we can connect today's web developers to what those guys were trying to achieve and to what they did achieve. So I'll give a few more detailed case studies in the television bit later. But first I want to get on to some perhaps deceptively simple suggestions. I recently re-encountered this graphic. This is the original slogan for the web project. 1991, 92, 93, before the web broke out of its early phase, before it became mainstream, this was the slogan they were using. They didn't call it a knowledge sharing initiative. This was, let's share what we know. And I found the graphic last week, or week before, looking around the old archives of my former employer, W3C. And somehow this slogan has been dropped or forgotten, or the graphic files didn't load in modern software. But it's really beautiful, I think, and it captures to me why I care about the web. The web is very frustrating to deal with. It upsets existing practices. It threatens jobs. It costs people money. It's full of pornography and violence and scary things. But to me, it's fundamentally a beautiful, amazing thing. And I'm happy to have been part of improving it. I think if I'd given another title for this talk, it would have been How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Web. I came to the web with one foot in the library world and sort of a suspicious eye to it. It didn't seem quite right. But this slogan is spot on, I think. And if we take the slogan and make it our own, it gives us a guide to understanding how to survive in the age of the web. So I promised to talk about fundamentals for hybrid models. And that sounds potentially quite formalistic. I'm not going to give a technical account here of how we combine various models. It's more a sociological account. I lied when I said I was a philosophy graduate. I was a philosophy and sociology graduate. And I'm very interested in how different communities on the web manage to collaborate and talk to each other. So in the semantic web scene, So I was part of the Semantic Web project at W3C. We had this problem of database people, artificial intelligence people, information retrieval people, library people. We had to get them to talk to each other somehow and to understand each other's languages. And I think we have the same issue now with professional classification on the web. It's very, very easy to make false suppositions. So we see blog posts or even conference papers talking about tags versus classical descriptions, to talk about automation versus cataloging, to talk about ontologies replacing classification, or Web 2 replacing the old stuff. And I think that's fundamentally a huge mistake. I'm very happy that we haven't seen it here this week, but the web is full of this kind of rhetoric about the old ways and the new ways and which one's going to win. We've got now this trillion pages, trillion URLs, with only 7 billion people. So we have to do everything we possibly can to combine every possible technique to make this information accessible. Information is reproducing faster than we are. So to me, hybrid means sharing. It means combinations of tools and data from different groups and organizations around the world. And to do that, we need standards. We heard yesterday about the ISO work. I've spent most of my time in the W3C community. So we produced SCOS, which came out of a European research project. We brought it into the standards process. So it took, I think, from original conception to finalization, it took 10 years. That's painfully slow progress. But we got something. I think it's okay for Thesauri. It's even good for Thesauri. It has some very interesting characteristics for sharing data on the web. It needs more work around classification. I think we'll hear more about that later today. It's very strong at letting data flow between systems. It's a technology that is fairly accessible to a modern developer, someone who's a programmer, just come out of college or university, doesn't know the history, doesn't want to read 1,000 history books, just wants to build a system, just wants to improve a website. And SCOS is fundamentally about letting data flow between sites and fundamentally about facilitating collaborations. Bibliographic facts and disciplinary views. When I look at UDC as a non-librarian, I see something that is to me a map of a domain. It's a guide into a literature. It tends to take an approach to description that's very different to what most people in the database and ontology community do. The people on my mailing lists at W3C who call themselves ontologists, they think of themselves as describing the world. So the life science guys there, they talk about genes, or the health people might talk about the structure of a healthcare system. They talk about things falling into categories and things having properties and relationships. So my friends at FAO are moving slowly from thesaurus-like data into ontological data. And rather than talking about maps of concepts, they're talking about the things the concepts are concepts for. So they're talking about the relationships between countries. They're building a system that aggregates all the country codes that exist in every UN system and tells you which countries have borders with which other countries. So they bridge information systems to factual systems. And we see that again and again in the ontology world. They're fundamentally fact-oriented. So the reason to bring this up first is I think this is where we cross into the web. A lot of websites contain factual or semi-factual, factoid, I say, data. And we've not done a good job yet of crossing over from navigating a discipline, navigating a subject hierarchy, navigating a map of a literature or of an academic or research community, seamlessly into data about the things that those information resources are about. And so there's massively increasing quantities of basic factual data out there now in the web. It's using the same technology stack that SCOS uses. So I'll give some examples later. But we see maps, we see biographies, Wikipedia, we heard yesterday, can be thought of as a big database. Data.gov, Obama's doing this stuff. In the UK, Gordon Brown's doing this for as long as he's in power. Ontologies, they can model books or they can model the world. And we seem to need both. We seem to need to combine systems of factual and documentary information. So there's several kinds of hybrid system I care about here. There's the mixing of human classification with automatic classification, the building of workflows where you begin with automatic and semi-automatic and pull it through humans, or tagging, beginning with user tags and clustering and aggregating them at scale and pushing that back into the web and combining those, the best of user tagging and the best of library techniques. All the projects we heard about yesterday, I think they're the tip of the iceberg. They're just a fraction of what's out there. And at the moment, everybody begins from scratch, or they begin from the base of having the UDC books, maybe the DVD, the cataloguing practice, the description practice, and everything that's achieved in every project that uses, say, UDC or Dewey or one of the big thesauri, everybody begins again. So if you take LCSH from the Library of Congress and you customize it, as we heard yesterday, for a UK undergraduate audience, so that the work into taking LCSH, refining it, modernizing it in certain ways, improving it for a certain user community, that's been done, but it's not been shared back into the web. And what I'm going to suggest here is that we've got a fairly obvious technology that we can use to share that information back into this community. And my proposal is just simply, we put our data back into the web. When we do something interesting with a thesaurus, with UDC, with just a set of fields, or with tags, maybe another example. Every time a user searches for something, finds it in a library and goes and borrows the book, every time they're on Amazon and they search and they find and they buy, that's a piece of evidence that links their search term to everything else we know about the thing they bought. We don't in the wider web community yet have a flow whereby that knowledge is aggregated and brought back into widespread use. So if you improve a scheme in your university, someone else will do the same thing, maybe at the same time, maybe 5 years later, in another university. And the web isn't great for everything, but it's pretty good for information sharing. So my proposal here is just put this stuff back into the web. There's a huge community of technologists who will help you. There are new standards like SCOS that will help you. And if we do that, then other people will find it, they will use it, and they will improve it. So once again, to emphasize, we need to put our data into the web. It needs to be public, downloadable, and linkable. It will really help if it's in standard formats. If it's not, that's okay. People will reformat it. More than this, we need to do it enthusiastically. If it's hidden away on a website behind some disclaimers, or you have to send a fax with a legal signature on it, the data will be ignored. And that's just the way the web developer community work. I feel almost rude coming here and saying this. It's like walking into someone's house and saying, hey, give away all your stuff. And I'm not asking you to give it away. In that sense, I'm asking you to share it so that other people build on it. If this is done enthusiastically, loudly, and soon, by soon I mean in the next 5 years, then I think we can look to a future where every computer science researcher, every usability engineer, every interaction designer, everyone working with information systems in the modern web, builds on this stuff. They use it for their thesis project. They build a prototype around it. That's not happening today. And it's not a disaster, it's just very, very sad. So what kinds of data am I asking you to put into the web? More or less everything you can afford to or dare to. But in particular, thesauri, in particular, classification systems, knowledge organization systems of every kind. Consider it putting it on the public record, putting it into an environment where it's going to be found 100 years later. So we need more controlled lists of names and named entities. We need these to be cross-referenced. We need the configuration files from Anders Autoclassifier we heard about yesterday. We need every association people have built between tag clouds, user searches, and existing systems. Anything that can bridge information systems. Because whenever we can bridge information systems, we can make life easier for users. We can defragment data, and we can hopefully make access to information just a little bit more seamless. I think translations are also in particular worth emphasizing. So I hate the word business model, but basically, who's going to pay for all this? I don't know if the phrase Netscape moment means anything to this audience. In the late 90s, there was a company very successful called Netscape. People often confuse Netscape with the web because everybody used Netscape's browser. They tried to build a business around it. It was hugely successful until Microsoft decided to build another browser and give it away for free. And as the 90s drew to an end, as the dot-com boom faded, Netscape realized that they were more or less doomed. They couldn't build a business around a web browser, because access to the web was just going to be there for everybody for free. It was going to be built into operating systems. And that also made angry the biggest, angriest company in the world and upset Microsoft. So that they knew that Netscape's future was, as a browser vendor, was measured in weeks and months. We won't have a Netscape moment in this community. There will just be a gentle, peaceful decline in usage. I don't particularly care to know the sales figures for Dewey Decimal or UDC's data sets, but I know that people are buying less and less CDs in general. The music industry's ability to sell music has been heavily challenged by the web. the 20-year-old programmers that build websites don't buy music, and they don't buy DVDs full of data either. And the PDF we got yesterday was great, but it would mean nothing to a modern web developer. Because of that, I think over the next 5 to 10 years, we will either see the practice that we have in this community fade into more and more of a niche. It will stay in the library world, but it won't be a part of every website. It won't be built into my mobile phone. It won't be built into the information systems that come with our televisions. And I think by using the web, by sharing data in the web, by somehow finding business models that allow us to give this stuff away rather than charge for it, we have a hope of bringing that 100 years of history into the modern web. So there are many, many open data communities out there who've found some compromise for getting things done without people being paid in the traditional fashion for data. So Wikipedia, we heard about yesterday, it's an amazing resource. It's also a chaotic and messy resource, but it's getting better, and it's just going to keep getting better, I think. Data.gov, the US initiative to share government data, is a suggestion that if things have been funded by public sector, they deserve to be available to the public and to be part of the public record. Same thing happening in the UK. MusicBrainz and OpenStreetMap, I mentioned here, they're more from the technologist community. MusicBrainz is a collaboratively maintained database of all the music that exists. It's got a bias towards popular music, but it's improving for classical as well. It's good enough that the BBC chose to use it, chose to base their new music site around it, and also to pay to hire a developer to work on it. So that there's a possibility of a business story there. One of the other things that MusicBrainz does is they make all the data freely available. Most of it is public domain. I think maybe 20% of the facts in there they're still freely available for non-commercial use, and you can negotiate a license, which is not very expensive, for commercial use. So there's a possible story there. Another model they looked at was timed release, so people would pay for early access to the data. So maybe you get the edits and the updates this year, if you pay for it next year, if you wait and don't pay. Anything like this. There's so many combinations. OpenStreetMap is another collaborative system. It has very fine street maps of a lot of cities in particular around the world. Amsterdam, Cuba, I was looking at yesterday. Freely created by people on bicycles with GPS units. The web is full of passionate, obsessive, crazy maniacs who like to describe things, like to share data, like to link data. They're not trained librarians, they're not trained subject experts. And like me, they would feel a bit awkward and embarrassed about messing with the subject scheme and messing it up and doing it wrong. I think if you think about these people as an audience who can help you, who would love to help, and who just need a framework for collaboration, then there's some forward path there. So I think there's no magic answer, but the web is inevitable. It's an information system where people expect things to be free, to be linked, and to be largely public. So I'm going to break from my sermon and talk about television briefly. My day job at the moment it's fantastic. I work in television, I can say that, and I'm only partly lying. I work on a project at the Free University in Amsterdam called NoTube, and we're looking at the collision of television and the web. And the web always messes things up. It's messed up the music industry, it's messed up librarianship, it's messing up television too. So in this work, my personal inspiration is a fantastic documentary made by Douglas Adams 20 years ago, just before the web took off. He made this fantasy documentary called Hyperland. It starred, Tom Baker from Doctor Who. And to me, that's guiding the work we're doing around thinking about what television could become in a connected age. So I'll give an example briefly of the BBC and their use of UDC and the London classification, long class. I'll give a small case study I'm working on around modelling debates and dialogue, and a quick demonstration of one of the user interfaces we're considering as a possible navigation system. And at the same time, I'll try and reinforce my sermon about giving all your data away. So Douglas Adams talked about hypertext, and he talked about interactive television as being essentially the same thing. Before the web came along, people thought of the future as being what television became. They didn't know about the internet. Most of them didn't have laptops or PCs. So the natural metaphor for the future was the future of television. And it's strange that of all the things the web has changed, the end-user experience of television has really not changed that much. Stuff is broadcast, or you can watch videos on the web. But the hypertext that we experience on the web, the ability to link anything to anything, it hasn't happened yet in TV. And the reason I'm most excited about this NoTube project is I think we're just at the historical point where we can build hypertext television. I can use this thing as a remote control. I can stop my TV, and I can annotate, rate, cross-link using the smartphone as a remote control. That technology was not really there even 3 years ago. So it's a fantastic time to revisit television and to think about how you would describe everything on TV. It turns out it's been done before. BBC have been describing everything on TV, everything on radio, every person who was on a show forever. And since the 60s, they've been using UDC to do it, or heavily adapted, customized, television-oriented version of UDC. So can I ask for a show of hands here? Who in the room knew that the BBC used UDC? So are you all asleep? Or who didn't know the BBC? All right. Do you see the problem? They've gone to huge trouble to describe everything they have in massive detail, and almost nobody knows. I wrote some slides in the summer about LONCLAS, the London classification. I put them on the web. Within a day, my webpage with the slides was the first hit on the web explaining what LONCLAS was. And this is not because the BBC is secretive. It's because we've failed to turn subject classification into an online community, I think. They use it in their archives. They know they've got something very interesting there. They know they've got something very old there. And they don't know where to go with it. Not because they're dumb, but because the answer is not obvious. So I'll show something of LONCLAS, because I love it, and then start to think about what television could become with this kind of system at its heart. So LONCLAS is, to me, a cultural heritage artifact in its own right. Can you read this at the front? These are actually all the codes in LONCLAS that describe Mrs. Thatcher, who, even after all these years, strikes terror into my heart. I grew up in the 80s, and looking around the UDC system that the BBC have used, LONCLAS, it was like a cultural map of my country, or all the stuff I saw on television as a kid. So as you zoom in, you see a lot of events. You see a lot of Thatcher and the TARDIS on Alexis Sale, for anyone who's watched that. Thatcher's rejoice statement after the British recapture of South Georgia. Lots and lots of events in particular. That's very key to television material. Shots of things. They've got a whole vocabulary for talking about the angles of shots and the visual and acoustic characteristics of their content. But there's also just core UDC in there. So another example, Olympics. All kinds of things telling the story of the Olympics, the Paralympics, the politics around the Olympics. This is a great contrast with, I think, ontologies and with also Wikipedia. On Wikipedia, you're lucky if you find 3 or 4 pages about a topic. Things are centralized around a hub page. And my understanding of UDC, especially with its synthetic aspects, is you get many different perspectives, many different characterizations of overlapping topics. So Olympics comes up again and again. Communism, it maps the decline of the great age of communism. What we got in there? Lots of countries, lots of events, a modern art exhibition, possible nuclear leaks, Brezhnev, da-da-da-da-da. Princess Diana, bless her. A lot of stuff about Princess Diana in there. Not because she's the most important thing, but because she was always on television, always on the radio. And again, events and issues and some readable examples now. So the first one here, R672:32.007(47), Yeltsin:342.518(I) Thatcher, is the BBC's way of talking about two shots of Margaret Thatcher and Boris Yeltsin. As you can imagine, this is very sparse data. There's probably only one of those. But it's data that has the potential to be very creatively navigated. It's data that has the potential to be at the heart of a fantastic website where people can explore the history of the world, explore massive archives of cross-related content in beautiful ways. And it's not being used. So we see the familiar compositional semantics of UDC here. There's a code for letters of apology. And you can see that's built from the combination of letters, postal services, because everyone writes using the postal service, and resignation letters. This is a letter of apology to TVAM, which was a British breakfast TV show. Won't go into those details because I'll say something wrong and feel stupid. But the core point I want to get across is this has been part of BBC practice for a long time. They're modernising, bringing things into the web, trying to figure out what to do. And if you look at it from an engineering perspective, there's a big problem. So this technique, it's very expressive, but it's also got its origins not just before the web, not just before the internet, but before computers and modern linguistics. It hasn't changed in 100 years or so. A software engineer, given this database of stuff, and I've got some of it on my laptop, software engineers want to know how to parse these codes, how to store and query them, how to build a website that allows people to bounce around and explore not just letters of apology, but other letters, not just letters to TVAM, but letters from other conservative politicians, not just letters, but emails, and they can't do it. So there are some fragments of code around floating on the internet. There's copies of pages from people's PhDs. There's the occasional research projects will have something. But basically, there's no shared repository of materials for computing, for building software systems with this stuff. And the title of the seminar had a mention of usability. And we talk about new routes and roads to usability. And I think that, as I said earlier, there's no magic answer. There's just 1,000 small steps, 1,000 small improvements. But unless we get the basic building blocks in there for software engineers and for usability engineers and for interaction designers, we won't get that usability. We won't get the creative interfaces, the 3D interfaces, the hypertext television. It won't be built on this stuff because people won't have been able to do the basics. They will have spent 2 years writing a parser for these numbers and codes and slashes. We need to fix that. So how do we modularize? How do we link out to more information about TVAM, to more information about Mrs. Thatcher, to artists and to topics? How can we build a system so that when I walk past the street in Amsterdam where a famous writer once lived, Wikipedia knows that, a library knows the things that writer book, the books that writer wrote, and the web knows that I can get free electronic text from that writer. So if we can put together these small pieces and link up the library data with the Wikipedia data, with the BBC data, we can build something quite extraordinary. Last television example. I'm going to talk a bit about a project called Debate Graph. And it's just one of several projects that explore the modeling, not of consensual maps, which we have in subject classification, but of the lack of consensus around debates and disagreements, the structure of science, the structure of argumentation. Dagobert talked about this a little bit yesterday, and I hope this picks up where he left off. So this is a project that CNN are collaborating with recently. So what do we say here? They want the show to stir the global conscience. She says she's witnessed so much that it's time to start making sense of it all. And as I talk also with my journalist friends in the BBC, they have this need to connect stories and narratives to historical context, to the arguments and debates and the evidence, which you can't squeeze into a news broadcast. You can't squeeze into a newspaper article. And it turns out to be quite hard. It's hard in part because getting anyone to create metadata is hard. Getting them to create complex, rich metadata is both hard and expensive and historically unsuccessful. But this Debate Graph project, I think, is onto something. So that on the CNN site and on the Independent site, you can try it out. And I tried it out the last 2 weeks, and it turns out you get a graphical concept map view of a debate. So what they were trying to do was they were trying to give historical context on the recent fuss around Iran's nuclear ambitions. So if you're walking in the street, you pick up a tabloid paper in the UK, you might pick up the Sun or the Mirror. It will say, these terrible Iranians, they're going to build a bomb and kill us all. How do you give more context on that? How do you give the backstory? So I talked earlier about Thatcher and her famous apology in the 1980s to TVAM, long forgotten. I forget what that was about. I'll talk in this example about another famous apology. So the map that Debate Graph provided on their site says, you know, what does Iran want? Why are they building this terrible bomb? What does the international community want from Iran in responding to Iran's nuclear ambitions? And connected off of these, edited through a wiki kind of style, there are pieces of evidence, there are positions, counterpositions, claims and counterclaims. So what does the international community want from Iran? Has a link, a subtopic, I think, to the history of Western involvement in Iran. As we explode that one, we see all kinds of things. And you can see that I've been interfering here. So two of these blobs were not here a month ago. If you look at the history of Western involvement in Iran, it gives you some context and background on what's going on now. It gives you the ability to empathize a bit more with how Iranian politicians and public might be thinking about this. So what we've linked in as evidence in this graph is Obama's speech in Cairo in June. And I've also yesterday I put in LCSH. So you see up here in the top right, id.loc.gov/authorities/SH85067887, that is the Library of Congress's way of talking about this topic, about talking about the, they said it originally Occidental, but the Western involvement in Iran. The Obama thing is different again. So the Obama thing is back with television. Roughly 30 minutes through a one-hour talk, Obama said something quite interesting. He made a famous apology, or a politician's half-apology. He said that back in 1953, 1954, basically the US government, with its faithful helpers, the British government, overthrew the democratically elected Iranian government. And that's a very interesting little fact. It's not going to be in the documentation, in the metadata for that page on the White House site. But it's a fact that anyone can write into this wiki. You can attach to this wiki videos and links to the web that help other people explore the data in unexpected ways. So the metadata describing this video file, amongst many other things, can say at 30 seconds, at 30 minutes and 45 seconds in, that we have a famous apology from the politician Obama on the topic of the thing that the Library of Congress call SH8507887. And this is where we come back to my point about the web. That by adding this into the graph that links the newspaper article, that links the video, links the Wikipedia, we connect back to literature, we connect back to books that have been written on this topic, we connect back to the Library of Congress. And the technology to support this is just the web. By putting LCSH in the web, by giving every LCSH code a web page that's available for humans and for machines, we allow LCSH and all the huge community of practice around LCSH to be connected to these modern techniques that are showing up on websites, that are showing up in interactive TV systems. And it's not rocket science, but it involves making this leap and putting your data in the web. And that's never a comfortable thing to do. I think it's worth it. So once you've connected over from debate graph, you navigate through the graph, find background evidence, find LCSH, you're on the SSH site, and that tells you, here's some more literature. Here are broader terms, so Iranian civilization, Western civilization. And this is the only technical slide, and I don't expect you to read it. All it really shows is that by using SCoS as a useful web technology, we can put data in the web that modern developers can build information systems with. They can build interesting, creative, unexpected navigation mechanisms to connect topics and people and argumentation and video and Obama and Iran and anything you can think of. And the way of doing it is by putting this kind of data in the web. So here you see the codes for SCoS broader, the alternative label, dates, you know, familiar stuff, but the only difference is it's in the web in a modern web format. And by doing that, I think we bring in a huge class of developers who like to build things, who like to explore and hack and program. And we don't just bring in coders, we bring in interaction designers, usability experts. We grow the field. And right now this is a shrinking field. So here's another quick example of something we're thinking of using with interactive TV. This is from the Freebase project. Freebase is an aggregation of lots of free online data sets. It tends to be factually oriented. But what they've got here that I think is interesting and connects to the facet work and the facet tradition in the UDC data is the style of navigation. So I'll just show three slides here. The first, it shows someone's done a query and brought back everything that is a skyscraper. And you see a little summary view. So we've got Bank of China Tower, Central Plaza in Hong Kong, Chrysler Building. Then they do a filter, I won't show you, that shrinks down from all the things that are skyscrapers to a smaller set, all the things that are skyscrapers in America. So we've got Chrysler again, the Empire State Building, the World Trade Center, as well as the United Nations headquarters. It's a small set of things. And what's interesting about this demo from Freebase, the parallax system, is that it's based on navigating not around specific things or specific ideas, but collections of things, sets of things. It's very fluid about the sets of things you can use. They could be letters of apology. They could be politicians. They could be places. Where there are specific things, it brings in factual data about those and allows you to pivot and navigate and cross-link using those, but always in terms of sets. So the set of things here is the set of skyscrapers that are in New York. Having shrunk your set down, it then allows you to expand again to a different set. So you can see on the right-hand side, they've picked out architects. All the things that are skyscrapers in New York, we find their architects. That's not a subset. It's not a set of information resources. It's a set of people who are architects. And then you can navigate again. And you can see here at the top. Okay, you probably can't read this. Skyscraper, architect, structures designed. So you've shrunk down to American skyscrapers. You've jumped to another set. Skyscrapers... designers, the architects, And they've gone back out to everything that's designed by one of those guys, one of those women. And because it's Web 2, it always ends up on a map. So bounced around the set graph as long as you want, changing the filters, expanding and contracting until you've got something interesting. And then you bring it into another environment. So you can put it onto a timeline, you can put it onto a map. And I don't think this is the answer to everything. But it's just a taste of the kind of work that's out there, working with free data and free code. And I really want the kind of people who build this system to be working with EDC, to be working with every thesaurus, every classification system that's out there. And right now they're not. I'm starting to repeat myself, so I think I'll wind up. Hypertext television. So I think we can see a future of television where every show, every scene can be linked to its context, to dialogue, to debate, and to the literature that goes back to the beginning of time, as long as the basic structures are in place. And for me, the big question is, who puts those structures in place? And we have a massive communication gap right now between the engineers that are building these technology systems and the people who've built our existing information structures. All those books will never be reclassified. They will be in Dewey, they will be in UDC until the end of time. All those TV shows at the BBC will never be reclassified. They will always have those UDC codes. So we need to keep our understanding of those systems alive in a way that can allow content to show up on television, show up on mobile phones, show up in fancy new systems like Parallax. And I think to achieve that, we need hybrid systems. We need journalists doing this, librarians doing this, users and experts doing this. We need everyone doing this. And to do that, we need to put our data in the web. So that's the end of the television lecture. I mentioned this already, I'm going to just emphasize, LCSH is already in the web. This wasn't easy for them. It caused a huge fuss, but it's there, it's up there. Every concept in LCSH has a web page, officially, on the Library of Congress website, for humans and for machines. And that to me, is a fantastic step. In a sense, the SRI are easy, because they're finite. The synthetic system in UDC is tricky, because you can have an infinite number of pages. But that doesn't stop the data going into the web. We just need to figure out exactly how. And it's not just LCSH. There's AgriVoc from FAO. I can't even say that, RAMO. Wikipedia's up there. Dewey and UDC are experimenting, I know. And there's a dozen or more thesaurus systems public in the web already using SCoS. So I'm going to end with an exercise in empathy. Imagine you're a 20-year-old programmer. You don't remember before the web, never mind the mundaneum. You've been asked by your boss, maybe, to make a useful, usable website from data full of UDC codes or Dewey Decimal codes. You see numbers and punctuation, and just help. What do you do? You're told it's some library thing. You can go to the library and ask, and they're not going to be able to help you build a system. How can we empathize with people in the situation? How can we get them engaged in the history that goes back before their grandparents were born? How can we connect the systems they're building with other information systems that have complementary resources? I think the answer really is what I said before. Put the data in the web. It's simple. It's easy. Put a spreadsheet in the web. Put a Word document in the web. Ideally, put SCoS in the web. If you don't put SCoS, someone will take it and turn it into SCoS and help you. I'm going to end with a quote from Ted Nelson, who's the father of modern hypertext in the 60s. I'm just going to read this. Techies, the guy we were empathizing with earlier, the girl we were empathizing with earlier, techies think that electronic documents on the World Wide Web are something completely new and that they own it, exactly the way every generation of teenagers think they invented sex and it's their secret. But it's not new, and they don't own it. Word processing and the web are not intrinsically new. They are literature. And what is literature? It's, amongst other things, the study and design of documents, their structure and connections. So today's electronic documents are just literature, electronic literature. And the question is, what electronic literature do people really need? And Ted can be very grumpy about the web, but he's spot on here. There's a tradition going far back before the web that we need to connect web systems to. And the only way I can possibly think of doing that is by sharing the data that's at the core of it. So getting Dewey fully in the web, getting UDC fully in the web, making databases of the whole thing somehow downloadable, somehow usable by modern software engineers. And it's not just software engineers. It's interface designers, information retrieval experts, data mining researchers, ontologists. There's hundreds of thousands of people who can do something with this data. UDC, I think, has an invisible web. There's a huge community of practice linking libraries, not just across Europe, but across the world. Dozens of systems, data sets, mappings, local improvements, refinements, translations. And seminars like this, they're a fantastic way of sharing experiences and making collaborations. And I just want to, I'm really repeating myself now, but emphasize that the web is annoying in some ways, but it's a great way to share and link data. seminars are not enough. We can do one of these every year. We can do two of these every year. Put your data in the web and you won't be sorry. 5 years' time, imagine we come back here. What can we show? What data, what tools can we show to the people who make Firefox? So roughly a third of people, at least in Europe, navigate the web with Firefox. Open source software, passionate developer base. Yeah, the Firefox meeting I went to in Prague last month, they were chanting, "I love the web, I love the web." They're obsessives. Drupal 7, I was at a Drupal conference in Paris last month. This is a software system that powers hundreds of thousands of websites. They're enthusiastic about RDF. They're enthusiastic about SCOS. They've got taxonomy modules, dozens of them, because they want to make better navigation systems. What can we offer them? Or OpenOffice. The Sun pay for a developer at OpenOffice who's been putting RDF technology into the heart of an office suite. These are the tools that create the documents, that create the information chaos that we can't navigate. What can we offer them that they can put in there at the source of the chaos? Well, Google. What can we say to Google? Right now, we haven't got enough to say. Warning sign from yesterday. Someone said, why don't you show the labels on the codes? And the answer was because we have to buy a license. Right? Really awkward to say this, and I'm embarrassed, but the license thing somehow has to stop. The data just needs to be in the web, and it's not just the job of the UDC consortium to figure it out, it's the job of the whole community to figure it out. And there'll be lots of tricks and techniques and business strategies for doing it, but people will stop paying for this kind of data. And if they have to pay for UDC, if they have to pay for DUI, they will use Wikipedia instead. And Wikipedia is a fantastic resource, but it doesn't have the compositional semantics that give those navigation possibilities. And because of that, if people move to just using Wikipedia, they're losing out on something huge. So for me, the road to relevance in the modern web is through developers, designers, and content creators. Without them, we'll drown in data on the web. But without our data, those guys, they won't know how to help, and they won't realize that they want to help. So, thank you. Time for questions.
My day job is to be an educator.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately my question is at a crossroads. We could pick up on a business model and the problem of the monopoly right of the standards bodies, which I regard as an impediment to the utilization of UDC. We could move in the direction of the professional and ethical issues about the sorts of cases you were making, for example, Iraq in 1953, or Iraq in 1936, or Iraq in 1910. We could move in the direction of classification schema and how you teach them. We could move in the direction of SCOTS and how you teach it. Now, my modules are 150 hours of student work. That's not my fault. I didn't design that. In 150 hours, my experience is that a final year undergraduate cannot build a working SCOS demonstration of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And in 150 hours, a final year undergraduate cannot build a working demonstration of a usable thesaurus with a manageable topic. If they can't do either of those things in 150 hours, they certainly can't do both. So what
mm-hmm.
should our approach to education be at this crossroad?
Good and complicated question. I think I can't argue with you. This is hard stuff. The only answer to me is, yeah, let's share what we know. Let's not give each student the task of building something from scratch. Give them open source code. Give them community libraries. I mean, I was trying to persuade a BBC developer last year to parse UDC codes, and we got a certain way in. We got something that kind of worked. We didn't know if we'd done it right. Give them a library that does that. Give them a basic system using Drupal and let them improve it. Break up the work. Have project teams that do part of the problem each. To make a collaboration with a library somewhere else on the planet. Every year, we'll just get better at this. I realize I'm between you and your coffee. Any more questions, quickly?
More questions?
Oh.
Yeah.
and also a consultant. one word I tried to avoid was everything. Right now, we don't have enough in public, enough on the public record. So my friend Robert Kay built a US nonprofit around the Music Brains project, and he realized that if everything was given away, there would be no money to pay him and the other developers to maintain the project, and the users of the data would then suffer because it would go stale. And finding a balance between keeping it so closed that no one builds systems on it and so open that no one's paid for it is the challenge of the modern web. I think with things like UDC, with the backbone systems that are already at the core of collaboration, they need to be public. Maybe not all of it, but most of it. Maybe not public immediately, maybe public a year after the people who pay have got it. But we don't have nearly enough public right now, so it's a matter of degree rather than absolutes. There will always be information people pay for, that's perfectly right. In the UK right now, there's a huge debate around postcode data. Is postcode data something that you should pay for, or is just the core that other people build businesses around? And I think there's a strong case in the UK that postcode data is the public record. It helps you talk about your neighborhood, the businesses, and so on. And then people can sell business data around postcode data. And I hope there's a similar story with classification. Does that make any sense to you? Okay, in that case, I should emphasize, in case anyone misunderstood. I'm not saying we put every piece of data in the web, but that we need this common backbone that is shared across the community. Yes.
Yeah.
And that will help people build businesses. Yeah, exactly, structural stuff.
Yeah.
One more, maybe?
Final for the moment, because this is endless subject. We are talking here, at least in this session, I understood well, mostly about standards and the business of the standards, the distribution. That's why it is copyright protected for several reasons, but the cost is to pay the right. But we are talking here about who pays the distribution of these standards and the machine to produce them. And that's for free. I can see a movement towards putting standard organizations like NISO, for example. I do not know about ISO, but I think it will have to change some way. Well, the standards are not the business. These are something for the community, and the business that builds upon standards are, etc. But communicating between systems and between systems and between businesses, different businesses, with these standards, that's not the business itself. Build new business here about a niche, a potential for business.
I think give the core for free.
Yeah.
Grow the community that uses this stuff so that every website uses it, and there will be 1,000 business models.
Yeah.
I hope.
And now we have coffee for tea.